Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much, first of all, for welcoming me to this group today. I say that every time I talk, but I really, really mean it today. This has been so lovely. So thank you, truly. You are a very special group, and that's very obvious. Grief is a paradox. On the one hand, it's a universally human experience, but on the other hand, it's entirely unique to each and every individual. Or consider the fact that here in this room, every single one of us could be grieving and yet feel an all-encompassing isolation at the same time. For some, grief makes us take action, and for others, it leaves us feeling paralyzed. It can strengthen the fabric of some relationships and rip others apart at the seams. Grief can and often is the most intense pain a human can experience, and it can also be the most beautiful gift. Somehow, all of these statements about grief are true. I want to pause here momentarily and be vulnerable with you. When I talk about grief, I sometimes feel like an imposter of sorts. My speaker bio talks about my experiences in grief education and grief support, but I am by no means an expert. And what I mean by that is I've not yet experienced the kinds of very intense grief that the people I support often have. So I usually say that I've been adjacent to that intense grief. I've slept by my best friend the night before her mom's funeral. I make pizza every year in honor of a little boy in my family who will forever be 3 years old. And I've looked for fossils with my cousin's daughter hours after her uncle died by suicide. So I've grieved, I am grieving, but in my times of grief, I've more so been a witness to someone else's. So I approach grief as a novice, and I hope I always do. And with that in mind, my goal today is for all of you to walk away with two things. First, an expanded understanding of what grief can look like and all of the paradoxes it entails. And second, tangible, authentic ways that each of you can support the grieving people in your life. But spoiler alert, grief cannot be fixed. The people we love that are grieving cannot be fixed. But through curiosity, companionship, and community, we can at least ensure that no one has to grieve alone. And see, I did three C's there too. So first of all, what grief can look like. You might be familiar with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief: denial, bargaining, anger, depression, and acceptance. And all of those can certainly happen, but those stages are often misunderstood. We know that grief is not linear. It does not happen in neat stages. And it definitely does not happen in any predictable kind of fashion. That said, there are many types of grief that can be named in very specific and often very validating ways. For example, you may have heard of anticipatory grief. This is grief that can occur before the loss itself occurs, such as when a loved one is in hospice, when your teenager begins applying to colleges, before you move across the country for a new job, and any other anticipated major transition in life. But there are many other types of grief that are less commonly understood. So just a few examples. There's collective grief. This is when a community is grieving a shared loss, such as the aftermath of a natural disaster, a mass casualty event, or the death of a prominent person in a community. There's cumulative grief. This is when somebody experiences multiple losses over time, and so there's a cumulative effect. Ambiguous grief. This is when the loss is not fully tangible. A classic example is a pet running away from home that never returns. There's secondary grief. This is all of the other losses that come with the primary loss. For example, if somebody becomes paralyzed and uses the function of their legs, that's a primary loss. But secondary losses might include the loss of independence, identity, belief systems, financial losses, relationships, and much more. There's disenfranchised grief. This is when we fail to validate somebody's experience, such as by telling them that they're too young to fully understand what's going on, or that it's not as sad because the person who died was very old. People who have experienced miscarriages, divorce, or the death of a pet often describe their grief this way. And there's more than these categories. Grief can be complex, inhibited, masked, and the list goes on and on. But let's not forget, grief is a paradox. So while these terms can be very validating, words alone cannot describe grief any more than they can describe love, as much as the poets have tried. When I think of my own grief, for example, I think less of words and labels and more of memories and abstractions, things like a Nerf gun fight, a dinosaur on top of a Christmas tree, a Manhattan right at 5 p.m., an unseasoned filet mignon, a Tom Petty song, Wildflowers, Mary Engelbreit decor, an Apple paperweight sitting on my desk, and so much more. And would it surprise you to know that many of the people I support are thankful for their grief? While the visceral, dark parts of grief are always there, many describe their grief as a gift. Author Sarah Jaffe puts it this way: "When my father died in 2018, I was upended by grief. Nothing I had read or experienced prepared me for how absolutely undone I would be. But it also, in moments, opened up a vast space of possibility. Having lost someone I could not fathom a life without, could I picture something totally different? Could we all, if we acknowledged our grief rather than shambling on like zombies, imagine collectively something new?" And there's also Stephen Colbert, whose dad and two brothers died in a small plane crash when he was only 10 years old. And he explains it this way: "I learned to love the thing that I most wish had not happened. You get awareness of other people's loss, which allows you to connect with that other person, which allows you to love more deeply and to understand what it's like to truly be a human being." In other words, confronting death can help us live more fully, exactly what this speaker series is all about. But of course, it's not a guarantee that any of us will respond to grief in this way. It all depends on our willingness to engage with our grief. My biggest celebrity crush, Anderson Cooper, explains this concept better than I ever could. And as a quick aside, I've had a crush on AC360 since I was a preteen. For my millennials in the room, if Tiger Beat had posters of Anderson, he would have been on the wall next to Jonathan Taylor Thomas, but I digress. For those of you who have not crushed on Anderson for the last 25 years, you may not know that his dad, Wyatt Cooper, died when he was only 10 years old, and his brother Carter died by suicide when Anderson was 21 years old. And his mom, the fabulous Gloria Vanderbilt, died in 2019 at the age of 95. And for many reasons, he did not engage at all with the death of his dad or his brother until after his mom's death, when he was going through her things and finding a lot of their things that she had saved over the years. But like any good journalist, he wanted to learn more about grief. And so he started a podcast. It's called All There Is, and I cannot recommend this podcast enough. He interviews the most amazing people. It's raw, it's beautiful, and you may even develop a crush on Anderson yourself. But in his own words, one of the most important things he's learned over the last few years of hosting All There is that, quote, "When you bury your grief to mute your sadness, you mute your ability to feel joy as well. You can't have one without the other." And that, for me, perfectly describes how I felt when I became a mom. I have twin daughters, Edith and Samantha, who are 9 years old. And before I became a mom, I had felt joy. I had a very fulfilled life. I was very happy. But after I became a mom, my capacity for joy skyrocketed. And that's amazing. It's a beautiful thing. But I know that my capacity for sadness and pain and suffering has also skyrocketed. To put it simply, it can't be avoided. Grief and love go hand in hand. So what do we do with all of these paradoxes? How do we help grieving people if grief can't be predicted, managed, let alone fixed. Since we cannot take the pain and suffering away, perhaps all we can do is be a companion. But how do we do that? First, I want to define what I mean when I use the word companion. According to Dr. Alan Wahlfeldt, who's my favorite when it comes to grief, he's the founder of the Center for Loss and Life Transition, he describes companioning this way. Companioning is about going into the wilderness of the soul with another human being. It is not about thinking you are responsible for finding the way out. And I'm going to say that again because I think it's so powerful. Companioning is going to the wilderness of the soul with another human being. It is not about thinking you are responsible for finding the way out. The imagery those words, the wilderness of the soul, evoke for me are things like darkness, fear, isolation, disorientation. And when someone we care about is in that place, it's only natural for us to desperately want to take their hand, guide them back onto a path and out of that wilderness. But what's often hardest for a companion is that's not our job. Our task, should we choose to accept it, is to be brave enough to be there with them in that wilderness, to observe and acknowledge their grief, knowing fully well that we cannot alleviate their suffering. But being a companion doesn't mean that we're helpless in that wilderness. In fact, I'm going to share four tangible things that we can all do when we're supporting a grieving person. And the first one's really simple. Do nothing. Say nothing. Get comfortable with silence. The meditation we had was perfect. I could not have picked anything better to help describe that. If you've ever worried about saying the wrong thing, which I'm sure we have all done, feel free to say nothing or to say, I don't know what to say. I'll share a personal example of a time in which I'm very thankful I did that. When I was in high school, a boy who was 1 year older than me died by suicide just a few days before Christmas. I'm going to call him James. And his girlfriend, who I'm going to call Amanda, she was in my grade, and she was one of the first people to find him after he had died. So at just 17 years old, Amanda had suddenly experienced more tragedy than any of the adults I knew at the time, and I think that's probably still true today. I wasn't very close to Amanda, but we were friendly, and in one class we were seated next to each other. And she took some extra time after winter break before coming back to school. But when she returned, I knew I wanted to say the right thing. I wanted to say something to acknowledge her grief. So she sat down next to me, and she looked like she was in a total daze. And the room was very awkward and silent. People were staring at her, and I can only imagine that was happening to her all day. So I wasn't totally sure what to say, but I noticed that she was wearing a really beautiful necklace. And it was the kind of necklace that you don't wear to high school. It had little diamonds on it. It looked really special. And so I said, "Hi, Amanda. I really like your necklace." And in a monotone voice, she replied, "James gave it to me." And I remember thinking, "Okay, Liz, you've got this. Say something supportive." So I said something like, "That's so special. It's really beautiful." To which she replied, "I hate him." Getting a little choked up thinking about it. And I remember sitting there in a stunned silence until the teacher mercifully started class. And in retrospect, I am so thankful that I had no idea what to say, that I was at a total loss for words. Because what could I possibly have said to ease her pain, her rage? It's okay that she was angry with him. And I have no idea if she remembers that moment. I have no idea if it made anything better, but I do know that I could have made it worse. I could have made it worse by trying to fill that silence with some kind of well-meaning platitude that she had been probably hearing nonstop. So this brings me to the second thing we can all do. The second thing a companion can do when you do want to use your words is to repeat back the exact words that the grieving person is using. Modeling those exact words can be very validating. And a classic example of this is avoiding euphemisms like passed away. If that's the language that the grieving person is using, then that's what I'll use. But for many, a euphemism like passed away is helpful for everybody else, not necessarily for them. And in fact, it can often downplay their experience. The person they love died. It's harsh, but it's accurate. And we need to realize that sometimes being a companion is hard because of our own discomfort. So here's an example illustrating this tip that I have for you. I used to live in Indianapolis, and I volunteered at an organization called Brooks Place, which was all about supporting grieving children. And it did that by creating systems of peer support. So there was a group of 6 to 9-year-olds who were all there because they were grieving the death of a very significant person in their life, which could have been anyone, but almost always would have been a sibling or a parent. And in this case, there was a child who was playing tag, but he wasn't playing it in the typical way. He was telling all of the other kids exactly where to go. He was telling the facilitators in the group exactly where to go and even like positioning their hands in different ways. And he was being kind of bossy. And the game went on for several minutes and everyone went with it. And then finally, he let out a huge sigh and said, "That's exactly how my brother did it." And I still get chills thinking about how powerful it was for that kid, for everyone in that group to do exactly what that kid asked him to do. My third suggestion is to offer specific help. When someone is in that wilderness, they may not know what they need, let alone have the strength to ask for what they need. So therefore saying, "Let me know if you need anything," or "If there's anything I can do, please let me know," can kind of be a waste of words. And I know I've said them, we've all said them, and we all mean well when we say them. But instead, spend some time thinking about what is a specific helpful thing you can do and ask if you can do that. And there's no right or wrong here. Can you mow a lawn or shovel snow? Can you offer to take the kids to and from soccer practice once a week? For example, when one of my neighbors, a family of 6, were going through a really difficult time last year, I discovered the hard way not to say, "Let me know if you need anything." Because to their credit, they took me up on it, which I love. But I learned pretty quickly that it wasn't very sustainable for me to be on call as a babysitter, to walk the dog, things like that. But what I could do, and what I did end up doing, was I wrapped all of their Christmas presents. There's 4 kids, there's a lot of Christmas presents, but that's my thing. I love doing that. And so that's what I did. And we can even do this for people that we're not very close to. In fact, sometimes the people we're the closest to are the hardest to grieve with. And that's because we're all dealing with our own grief. So therefore, it's not uncommon for some of the most helpful people to be on the periphery. A more distant friend or a coworker, for example. Take my husband, Nick. When he learned that his colleague's dad died a couple of years ago, he sent him a message. He's very good with grief because he lives with me. So he knew, "I'm gonna send my colleague a message." And he asked him to have lunch together just in case he wanted to tell stories about his dad. And they weren't terribly close. I don't think they've had lunch together since. But his colleague, weeks later, told my husband that was the single most helpful thing anybody did. And even though my husband was kind of on the periphery, think about it. It gave him the opportunity for it to be all about him and just talk about what he wanted to talk about. And what a gift that was. The fourth and final thing that I want to leave you all with is to remember the person who died. Grieving people tend to be surrounded by family and friends and helpers in the days immediately following a death or a funeral, but that direct support tends to dry up pretty quickly. And as the world keeps on turning and people get back to their regular lives, grieving folks are often left behind, and that can lead to feeling isolated or like they'd be a burden or ruin the mood, or bring things down if they were to bring their grief or their loved one up. In the monthly grief support group I facilitate for Hospice of Michigan, I listened one night as somebody said, "Sometimes I wish I had a visible scar from when the person died, And everyone else in the group nodded their heads in agreement. Because think about it, if you have a gnarly scar, people know you've been through it. You've been through something traumatic, and you don't have to pretend that that horrible thing never happened to you. And some people may even ask about it, giving you a chance to talk about the horrible thing that happened to you. One of my favorite things I've ever purchased is a perpetual calendar, and I brought it with me, and anyone who wants to see it can see it on the table over there. A perpetual calendar can be used year after year for anniversaries, birthdays, and any other important dates. So whether it's been 1 year or several years, I look at that calendar and I try to message my friends and family on the anniversary of somebody who died. And I'll just text them and ask, how can I celebrate your brother today, for example? And in my experience, my friends and family have appreciated this gesture, and selfishly, I really enjoy it too, because they tell me the best things to do in honor of their loved ones. Responses I've gotten include things like wear a black snarky t-shirt for a day, eat a giant bowl of pasta, you okay? Tell somebody a dad joke. I mean, I love learning these simple things that remind my friends and family of their loved ones, and I think it means something to them too. So to recap, when it comes to being a companion in the wilderness of the soul, you can remember their loved one, you can offer specific help, you can validate by using their exact words, or you can simply just be together, even if it's in silence. But if you take nothing else from today, I want to leave you with a simple encouragement to be curious. And I know that you're a very, very curious group, so this will not be hard for you. We all have an innate curiosity, but it's also a skill that can be honed and enhanced. Curiosity requires patience, slowing down, not thinking about what you want to say next, and instead just being present with that person in that moment. And I don't know about you, but in 2025, these are not simple demands for me. It takes practice. So don't aim to be an expert on grief. Find comfort, like me, in being a permanent novice. And to aid your curiosity, there are endless books and movies and podcasts and all of the things to keep learning. Some of my favorites, which I brought with me today, there's several things over there. And perhaps you're curious about these photos that have been up this entire time, some of which I've alluded to, others which I have not. So if you're curious, please feel free to ask. I love any chance I get to talk about the people that they represent. I'm so grateful again for this invitation to come be with you all today. Thank you.